Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning, we're pleased to have here back with us on the program two guests who've been here before, Julie Byron and Julia Whittington. Both of them are DVMs from the College of Vet Medicine here at the U of I. They're veterinarians. And we're doing the program here to give people a chance to call in and ask questions, particularly about companion animals. Mostly, I guess that would be dogs and cats, the ones that are most common in people's lives. Throughout the year, we do programs here about human medicine. We give listeners a chance to call in and talk about their issues and concerns about their family. Well, this is an opportunity for you to think about the health of the other members of your family, some the ones who most of them go on for legs. Questions are certainly welcome. If you have questions about illness, wellness, about diet and nutrition, about any and all kinds of health matters, you can certainly give us a call. And I know that the two of them will do their best to help you out. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Well, thanks very much for being
here.
Thank you.
A couple of things right off the bat that comes to mind that I think probably good to remind people about, particularly would apply for people who have dogs and where the dogs are spending time outside. You want to make sure they have water. You make sure that they can get out of the sun. Please don't keep them in the car.
Absolutely.
Right.
You got to think about how you would treat a child, because pets really are tame. They're small, they're alive, and they need certain things. And water especially is important in this time of year. You know, as you get dehydrated, so are your pets. And, you know, certainly we hear the very tragic stories of pets kept in cars, children kept in cars too long. And it's amazing how hot it gets in there. So we have to be very aware of those things.
Yeah. Now, I suppose some people would say, well, if as long as I crack the windows a little bit so that there's some air circulation that's not all closed up, is that going to be okay?
Not really. It's pets have a difficult time cooling themselves off. They really only have sweat glands on their pads of their feet, and they really have difficulty in thermoregulating, especially with a lot of hot air around them. So the amount of cool air that gets in through a cracked window is very small. If you think about it, you would be uncomfortable sitting in a hot parking lot with just the window cracked. So it's really not a good idea. You know, the dog and cat are probably going to be a lot more comfortable staying at home if you have just some quick errands to run. And certainly if you choose to take a pet with you on a trip or something, you probably want to make arrangements to be able to have them in a cooler air-conditioned area while you are not with them.
Okay. Certainly there are some breeds that were adapted to cold climates, and that they're not used to living their lives, at least their ancestors. They didn't live their lives in a place like central Illinois. You know, Malamutes and Huskies and dogs with long coats that were intended for colder climes. And I'm sure that those animals have a tougher time in summertime when it's really warm. Is there some sort of standard advice about doing something for them, like, maybe giving them a haircut or doing something with their coats? Or would that really not make very much difference?
It can make a difference. Groomers oftentimes will suggest to people with pets with very long hair, very thick coats, to cut it down a little bit during the summer. We'll call it a summer cut, and they basically just cut it down. It's important to keep them very well groomed, keep them brushed well to get rid of some of the thicker undercoat as it sheds off. Several of those breeds actually go through something like a molt, where they'll actually lose quite a bit of their undercoat as the weather warms up. Several of them may have already gone through it during the spring as the weather got warmer. And it does help keep them a little bit cooler. Keeping them free of a lot of that dead hair does a lot to actually improve the air circulation. But it is true, those dogs, even if their coats are cut shorter, even if you keep them well brushed, they need to be kept a little cooler, make sure there's lots of water available for them. And even leaving them outside with this really humid weather, even if there is a shady spot, you want to make sure it's a cooler spot. I'm not necessarily saying you have to have your pet as an indoor pet, but to have them be able to get down kind of maybe under a bush where the ground is maybe a little damp and thus a lot cooler and easier for them to get out of the heat. And the humidity, of course, is just as uncomfortable for them as it can be for us.
And I would just add, with the exotic pets, that the small mammals are highly susceptible to heat stress. And so we have to think about them as well. If you have a rabbit outside in a hutch, make sure they are in a well-ventilated cage. Make sure they're under shade and have shelter. If you have pets kept inside in cages, make sure they're in the part of the house that doesn't get too hot.
Okay. Well, we have several people here who have questions. We'll get right to it. We'll start first talking with someone in Rantoul. And this is line number one. Hello. Hold on a second. There, we got you. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I recently lost my pet of many years to pancreatitis, and I keep wondering what I could have done because I don't know what causes it, and I wonder. I will listen offline.
Can you tell us what kind of pet it was?
We got it at the shelter. The paper said that it was probably mostly Shih Tzu. She was a small dog. Weighed about 25 pounds, and she was not. She was about 9.5 years old.
Okay, you guys got enough basic information.
Is there anything? Is there anything else I can tell you?
No, I think that's probably. You know, it tells us quite a bit, actually.
Well, I'm going to hang up.
Okay. Well, thanks for the call.
Well, I'm very sorry to the caller that she's lost a family member. Pancreatitis is, for those who aren't aware, is an inflammation of the pancreas. It can occur in people as well. And in our pets, we see it probably more commonly in dogs than cats as far as being able to definitively identify it. There are some breeds that may be more susceptible to it. Miniature Schnauzers are one, and some of the smaller toy breeds also. And It's hard because we don't entirely know why some pets will get it and others will not. We feel that in miniature schnauzers it might be because they have a difficulty sometimes in regulating their cholesterol and triglyceride levels in their bloodstream. But in other breeds and even in some schnauzers who don't have problems with their cholesterol, they can develop it. Sometimes it will be exacerbated after a fatty meal or after they eat something that they're not used to. And it will cause a lot of enzyme release within the pancreas, and that can actually cause inflammation in the pancreas. It's not necessarily infectious. We don't necessarily identify bacteria that are related to this, but it can be very painful for the animal. It causes vomiting. They stop eating. They're very lethargic. Their abdomens hurt quite a bit. It can be a tough disease to manage. Certainly, we are able to treat a number of them if it's not really severe, but it can be a very tough disease to manage in the hospital even because these guys are just pretty miserable. And there really is no specific treatment for it. What we try to do is to support them through until their body can essentially heal itself. Some of the drugs that we would give to reduce inflammation in other parts of the body don't really seem to improve the disease process in these guys. And so if you have a pet who you're concerned may have either had a bout of pancreatitis previously or seems to have very sensitive stomach, I would just do my best to limit the treats they get, especially high-fat treats. Make sure they get enough fiber in their diet. It's very important. And honestly, they actually tend to do best with a more consistent diet. So, any of the quality pet foods on the market, there are low-fat dog treats out there on the market, things like that, or even things like carrots or vegetables as treats, rather than giving them some of the highly flavored or more fatty cheese-based or meat-based treats. That might help reduce it, the likelihood of it occurring in a pet who has a predisposition to it.
Okay. Well, I hope that that helps. If the caller wants to ask any more questions or follow up, she certainly may. Our guest here this morning in this part of Focus 580, Drs. Julie Byron and Julia Whittington. They're vets from the U of I School of Vet Medicine. And questions are welcome. You have questions about the animals in your life, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. The next couple of callers here are in Champaign, and the first one in line is line number two, and that's right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Good morning, doctors.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a cat who's approximately 12 years old, and he's always had trouble having bowel movements. He's had a definite constipation problem. A few months back, he had what I can only think of was a stroke. I took him to the university hospital, and they never were able to definitively diagnose what was wrong with him. But his problem with having bowel movement seemed to be exacerbated at that point. He really started having a problem. And the vet put him on Prepulsid and lactulose, and I'm giving him a high-fiber diet and also extra fiber capsules. And it's reached the point where even with all of this medication and food, he can't seem to have a bowel movement on his own. I've had to take him in twice now for enemas. And I'm seriously fighting with the decision to have him put to sleep. And I just don't know what to do at this point.
Well, there is a condition in cats called megacolon, and we don't, again, this is another one of those diseases we don't entirely understand the mechanism and how it develops, but in some cats, as they age, they may have difficulty neurologically being able to pass fecal material down through their colon. Some of it may be related to if there's a neurological problem similar to what you may have described if your pet had a stroke or some sort of injury to its neurological system. That might even make it harder because the animal may not have the same kind of ability to build up pressure in the abdomen or posture properly to be able to pass stool, and that can make it very difficult.
Sure.
Certainly, the treatments that you described are things that we generally do for pets who have problems with defecating, but in a number of cats that continually have this problem, if those therapies aren't working and you've increased the amount of lactulose, which is a stool softener, and Prepulsid is a medication that does help to improve the gut motility, its drug name is Sisapride, that if those things do not improve the situation, there is surgery that can be done to actually remove a portion of the colon, and it does help quite a bit with allowing those pets to be able to pass stool that's much softer. They don't have as much water taken out of it, and so it can make it much easier for them. They may have some problems with diarrhea afterwards, but they don't necessarily become fecally incontinent. They can still use the box and everything. It's just that their stools may be quite a bit softer. My recommendation would be to consider just making sure your cat gets plenty of water. Just like with people, it's very important for constipation to make sure they're well hydrated. Maybe talk to your doctor about increasing whether or not your doctor feels that increasing the dose of lactulose may be helpful. You're not going to hurt the pet by giving them more lactulose. You'll just make the stools softer. And if that does not help, then ask your doctor about considering surgery or whether surgery might be an option for your pet. And, you know, the surgery actually, generally the success rate is pretty good. These guys, the complication rate is not very high if you have somebody who's skilled at doing this procedure. We do perform it at the university. I don't know enough about veterinarians in the local area to know who else does, but it's certainly something to talk to your veterinarian about.
Okay, well, thank you for your information.
All You're right, very
thanks
welcome.
For the call.
Bye-bye.
Let's go on to line number 3. This is also someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I was listening to the first part of the program when you were talking about grooming and clipping.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you should state that dog skin is just as sensitive to sunburn as people's, and that really clipping a heavy-coated dog down to skin deprives them of part of their insulation to keep cool. You left that out of your explanations, and I thought I should ask you to please reiterate that you don't want to clip the dog right down to the skin.
Absolutely, I agree, and thank you for bringing that up. I think that is very important. Generally, when we recommend or we'll talk about clipping dogs, we will leave about an inch of coat, and the coat down at the skin is going to be much thicker, and so it will provide still a cooling layer. I certainly didn't mean to cut them down to the skin. Absolutely, they are very susceptible to sunburn, particularly if they have on the tips of their ears or on their nose, areas of their body where they don't have a lot of hair. And also in pets, cats as well, who have white fur and pink skin, particularly pink-nosed cats and pink with not a lot of hair on their ears, they absolutely can develop sunburns and even develop skin cancers in those areas secondary to a lot of sun exposure. Absolutely.
I think it should be emphasized to groomers that when they are asked to clip a dog right down to the skin, that they point this out, that you must keep the dog in the house then, or the cat, out of the sun. Mm-hmm. It's really cruel to clip a dog right down to the skin, and I see it done so often. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. You know, and you brought up a really good point as far as, you know, having your pets outdoors in this weather. Now that we've had some good rains, we're going to have the insects again. And one of the things we need to be very aware of are fly bite problems that we have on some of these pets kept outdoors. So using an insecticide on your pet will actually help prevent that as well.
Mm-hmm. And there are several out there on the market, and they will also help protect against fleas and ticks. There are some great flea medications out there, flea preventatives. There are some good things for ticks, and especially, you know, we are in an area where we do see tick-borne diseases. And, you know, the mosquitoes are out as well. And so if you have a dog or a cat, even if their pet is kept indoors most of the time, I still get bit by mosquitoes in the house. And so heartworm disease, which is transmitted by mosquitoes, is out there. And I think it's important to just make sure your pet is on appropriate heartworm medication and flea and tick preventative.
Mm. As far as the flea and tick prevention goes, do you have strong feelings about there are some things that are systemic, right? And then there are some things that essentially are applied to the coat or to the skin. Do you have strong feelings one or another about which of those strategies is more effective?
I personally do. I like the ones that go topically because that actually keeps the animal from being bitten in the first place versus most of the ones that go systemic work after the pet has been bitten.
And I agree with that, especially if you have pets who get allergies after being bitten by fleas. It definitely, even a single flea bite can set up an allergic reaction where they get really itchy and uncomfortable. So if you can actually prevent the fleas from even biting them in the first place, that's extremely helpful.
Okay. Well, let's talk next with someone in Indiana, Brazil, Indiana. Line number 4. It's our toll-free line. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I've got 2 great cats. I grew up with dogs, and I've got 2 cats now. And I have a couple of questions and a comment. My first comment is... I keep my cats indoors, and I just want to point out to people that keeping cats indoors is really environmentally a good thing to do. Millions of songbirds are killed by people letting their cats outside. They also take rodents away from birds of prey, so I wanted to mention that. And my 2 questions are, first one is the older cat. She's about 14, 15. She's a soft shell calico, just gorgeous. And she has arthritis. She's on steroids right now, last couple weeks, and she's responding well to it. And I'm just kind of wondering, are there any other options? I do yoga myself sometimes, and that helps me with my creaky bones. But is there some other option besides the steroids for her?
There are, actually. In recent years, we've had sort of more realization about cats getting arthritis. And I think people have been aware of it with dogs because you go running with your dog and realize they're slowing down. But cats are really good at hiding their diseases, and they may be very sedentary anyway, but it's good that it was recognized. Steroids are one option. Cats seem to have fewer side effects associated with steroids than dogs do. So generally it is an option for you. Another one is there's an opioid medication on the market called Tramadol, which a lot of veterinarians are starting to use in cats. It's very safe in cats. It's a pill. A lot of human pharmacies carry it. If your vet does not carry it, they can write a prescription for it. And the nice thing about it is it does give them quite a bit of pain control. It's a drug similar to something like codeine or morphine, but it doesn't really knock them out. They don't seem to get really sleepy or tired or things like that. And that's one of the really nice things about it. It's a synthetic drug. It doesn't have any addictive properties to it, or at least much less so than some of the more traditional medications like, you know, OxyContin and that kind of thing. And it really works very well. I personally have used it. I had 2 18-year-old cats, and I used it in both of them and felt it was very successful. The other nice thing about it is, you know, there are some non-steroidals out on the market. One of them is called meloxicam that have been shown to be somewhat safer in cats than some of the other non-steroidals like Remedil or, you know, other things like that that are used in dogs. But in older cats in particular who may have problems with liver problems or may be developing a little bit of kidney disease, really I think it's safer to be using something like Tramadol than one of the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories.
You mentioned yoga, and that's a field that very few veterinarians really delve into much. We have very little training in it, but there are some veterinarians in the community, and you would want to look in your community to see if any of them are familiar with using nutraceuticals in cats or herbal remedies in cats, and then certainly keeping your cat active, range of motion therapy, massage therapy, all of those can be very beneficial depending on your cat's demeanor. You know, but those are things that they help people. There's no reason to believe they wouldn't help pets. And, you know, finding somebody in your community who's versed in the use of herbal remedies in pets would certainly be beneficial.
Well, I'm just kind of wondering about, because I thought maybe I could help to massage her legs, but it actually hurts her when I do that.
Yeah.
And so I'm kind of wondering about that being an option. My other question is, Patches is the older one, and she's one with the arthritis. I'd say 6 months ago she developed some bumps on her skin. And I've taken her to the vet, and they just said it's some kind of allergy. Well, what I found interesting is the younger cat, Blackie, has bumps on her skin too. And they don't seem to be scratching them, so they must not be itching. But I'm just kind of wondering what in the world this could be, because it must be... I'm assuming it must be contagious in some way, shape, or form, and I guess it doesn't seem to bother them. They don't scratch, but I'm just wondering what this can be or if it is indeed any kind of a problem.
Well, I think that if the other cat's also developing it, it could be that they both have the same allergy. If you have changed anything like laundry detergent, air freshener, any carpet treatments or anything recently in the house or new plants or things like that that you may have brought in, if they're not scratching at them, certainly having your vet take a look at them is important. If your veterinarian is not as concerned about them and feels that they may be an allergic problem, something I would consider doing is looking around your house, just making sure you don't see any changes in the environment. We certainly are seeing more pets who have allergic problems developing them worse now because of there's lots of pollen in the air right now. It's a heavy allergy time. But also to consider making sure you've got adequate flea and control on them, because, you know, cats may not scratch quite so much, or they may do it, you know, in a way we're not seeing. They may just increase their grooming as opposed to actually itching like a dog would with its back leg. And making sure that you've got good flea control on them, I think, is real important. So if you're not doing that, you might want to check with your vet about that.
Yeah, if there's fleas in our house, I get flea bites.
Oh.
so I kind of can figure out if there are fleas in the house. Yeah. And I just want to again say, you know, keep your cats indoors. It's better for the cats, better for our wonderful birds. And I also want to say I'm a WILL member. And thanks a lot for your wonderful information.
Oh, well, thanks
okay.
very much.
Bye-bye.
We have one more person here in line ready to go, and we'll get to them. This is a listener in Urbana, line one. Hi. Is there a caller there, line one?
Oh, hi.
Yes.
Yeah. Could you? I'll have to cut off because I'm talking to somebody on another phone. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, you can call back later if you want. And in fact, anybody who has questions can call. Our guest this morning, Drs. Julie Byron and Julia Whittington. They're both veterinarians at the College of Vet Medicine here at U of I. And if you have questions about the care of companion animals, or so Julia is also interested in wild animals and wild animal medicine. So if you have that kind of question as well, I'm sure that she could help you out. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Just to follow up on the comments of the caller before this last one, I think that there are a lot of people who would agree with her that a cat can live a happy, healthy life indoors, and that cats do get into trouble when they go out. They can pick up disease, fleas, they get hit by cars, they get in fights. You know, it's probably a good idea to keep them inside. Having said all that, though, you do have to make sure that they get some exercise, because if they're couch potatoes, It's no better for them than it would be for us. Now that for some people might be kind of challenging, but you do have to find some ways for them to have physical activity, because You know, it's important for them just like it is for us.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, and a lot of people argue that, well, it's inhumane to keep a cat indoors. It's not natural. And I would say that it just simply depends on how you decide to keep them inside. I agree completely with the caller. I would be amiss not to, especially in my line of work. But certainly the risks of keeping your cat outside are very great, not just traffic accidents. You know, certainly we hear all the time of cats being hit by car. They run away, they fight. And then, of course, their impact on the environment is huge. And I think people underestimate the ability of cats to hunt. It's nature for them. And unfortunately, what makes them so dangerous to wildlife is they're not hunting because they're hungry. They're hunting for sport. And so the number of prey that they actually kill is unlimited or not limited by their hunger. That being said, there are ways you can exercise your cat at home. And like any other aspect with pet care, you have to schedule time to do it. It's not going to happen on its own. You can't rely necessarily on your cat to exercise themselves. So make it part of the routine and figure out what stimulates your cat. You know, whether it's getting another cat in the household to play together. That's what my cats do. They keep me awake all night running after each other. Or finding a toy that they particularly like and just schedule the time to do it.
Yeah. I know that there's on the Afternoon Magazine, there's a woman who's been interviewed periodically who's a cat behaviorist. And I think one of the things that she says is you have to think about what the natural pattern of the animal is. A wild cat would be you hunt, you feed, you groom. So it seems like her suggestion would be as well, you know, maybe the thing to do is to try and schedule your activity time, if you possibly can, when, say, you're gone all day. You come home, rather than the first thing you do going and filling up the bowl, take some time at that point to, you know, to mix it up with them some, get them to run around, get them to play. And maybe then after you have done that, then it would be the time to give them the food. And that's, you know, maybe it's not like what it is in the wild, but it sounds like it's a little bit more like the way that they're wired mm-hmm. up. And probably you certainly don't want to feed them and then get them to run around.
Right.
They may be less inclined to do it after having eaten.
Absolutely.
And it's, you know, those kinds of activities that simulate stalking and hunting are probably more stimulating to the cat. Actually, one of the problems we've started to see more that there are lots of cats indoors now is are stress-related disorders, and they oftentimes manifest themselves as cats urinating outside the litter box and spraying and that sort of thing. And it can be stress-related, and one of the big stress releases for pets, just like with people, is activity and playtime, and particularly if you have a fairly small home or apartment where they live, doing things like feathers, or my cats love my laser pen and they sell them at pet stores, mm-hmm. You know, just to mimic stalking and hunting behaviors and things like that. It really is a good stress relief for them, and it really gets them moving.
Yeah. And it's amazing how that's a hardwired behavior. All you got to do is crumple up a piece of paper and throw it down on the floor, and they're going to start chasing it around. They can't help it. They can't not do it. It's what they were made for. All right. We have several callers here. Let's get back to the phones, and next we'll talk with someone on the campus. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have to agree about the cats. My boss just had to let go of her elderly cat, and it was 22 and 3 months old.
Excellent.
And it lived inside its entire life. So they can definitely have a good life inside, and she has an 18-year-old still. But my question has to do with arthritis in dogs. My dog is a very active, almost like a border collie, although she isn't one, and she's always had problems with her toes. She has torn ligaments or tendons in her toes and has what the vet called non-infectious inflammatory problems in her toes, and her toes kind of swell up a little bit and get sore. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering if there's anything that's more of a topical analgesia or anti-inflammatory that I could put on her feet rather than giving her something systemic?
You know, we don't really have a lot of experience using those types of medications. Like with people, they use Bengay or Aspergream or those sorts of things. And we just don't know enough about about how pets are going to respond, whether it's effective. One of the difficult things, of course, in a lot of them is the moment you put anything topically on their feet, they're going to lick it off.
Yeah.
So that's always a difficult thing. One of the things, if you know, if it is, maybe it might be stimulated by certain contact dermatitis that might stimulate the inflammation. So if your dog is out running around at the park or in grass or something, just taking a damp washcloth and wiping out her feet between the toes, those sorts of things may actually help remove any irritants that she may have picked up that she may have a little bit of an allergy to. If she does have arthritis related to her or her problems with her feet, if you're not interested in using sort of more drug therapy, certainly things like glucosamine chondroitin, which a lot of people take as a supplement, there is a fair amount of evidence that shows that it does actually make these guys a little more comfortable in their joints. And I want to add on that for the caller who had asked about her cat with arthritis, glucosamine chondroitin appears to be of some use in cats as well. It's very safe. There's really not any side effects associated with it, although the occasional pet will get a little constipated if they get too much. And so it's certainly that's another option for you. And also maybe a little bit of just very gentle massage of the tissues to improve blood flow and range of motion, those sorts of things.
She doesn't like me in touch her skin.
Oh.
It's definitely not a skin problem. It's definitely the joints that
okay.
swell up. So I, and then, you know, on the x-ray you can see shadows in the bones there.
Mm-hmm.
So she is the kind of dog that just will ignore pain. So I don't always know unless she hurts it real bad if she's hurting. So, mm-hmm. but it does swell up from time to time.
You may want to consider the glucosamine chondroitin. It does take a couple of takes about 6 or 8 weeks after beginning to use it before you're going to probably see a lot of effects. But it is something you give them every day, not just when they're sore. And like I said, it's a nutraceutical. It's a nutritional supplement essentially that helps improve joint fluid quality and that sort of thing. So it may be something to consider.
I've tried that with my older dog. One of the two of those components. For sensitive dogs is a problem with nausea, and so I stopped giving her that. She has a bit of arthritis in her spine, but I think they told me it was the sulfated part that was could cause that sensitivity more than the glucosamine.
Mm-hmm.
Can you buy glucosamine alone?
You can for people.
Well?
I don't know.
Yeah,
if you
I think
can
you can for people.
Yeah.
Maybe touch base with your veterinarian about it.
Uh-huh.
I certainly have had clients who've used the human preparations that you can buy at health food stores.
Are there any scientific studies on it?
There are a few out there. There are a few out there that have shown that the combination of glucosamine chondroitin actually does seem to reduce the need for additional anti-inflammatory medication.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
Okay, thanks. And just to be clear, if people are thinking about this for their pets, obviously it's something that really they should talk about with their vets first. But there are the same preparations, the one that are some of the same stuff that's available for people. There are made specifically for pets.
There is. There are several companies out there that are making preparations for pets, and one of the biggest reasons. To look at those products versus the generics or the things that you can buy at the pet or at the health food store are because those companies have put research into two things. The first is that they have done some really extensive dosing studies and made sure that the doses available are appropriate for pets. You know, they're quite a bit smaller than we are. And so sometimes rather than having to break a capsule or something in half, which might affect its absorption into the body, they've actually formulated products and doses more appropriate for cats and dogs. The other reason is that there are some differences in the way some of these products are manufactured that improve their absorption into the body in dogs and cats. There are certainly some products out there that are just not well absorbed in pets but are very well absorbed in people. I can think of several, actually, off the top of my head. But if you look at the veterinary preparation, they're specifically formulated to be absorbed in dogs and cats, and so you get much more benefit.
Okay. Our guests this morning, Julie Byron and Julia Whittington. They're both veterinarians, and they're both at the vet school here at the U of I. And if you have questions about care of companion animals, that's really what we're doing here this morning. Give us a call. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And our next caller would be on line number 2. And this is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hi there. Good morning. My husband and I have a Humane Society cat. They think she has some Maine Coon blood in her, so she's a pretty big cat. She's 15, and it seems like the past year this has happened. I don't know how to delicately put this, but she tends not to keep her anal area clean anymore. So what we do is every other day, I guess, we have to wash that area. Is there something else we could do to take care of this problem?
Well, first of all, I wanted to say congratulations on adopting a Humane Society pet.
Oh, she's a cutie.
And I'm sure she's just got a beautiful coat. But,
You
know, as cats old age, you know, it may be arthritis related. It may be some other things. But, you know, she may have some difficulty bending all the way back to get to that area. The other thing is that for those of you who don't know, Maine Coons actually, or Maine Coon crosses, have quite long coats. And so fur back in their backside can get quite matted and that sort of thing. So something you may do is touch base with your veterinarian or a groomer in the area about maybe getting that the fur in that area clipped and kept short, which will help to some degree.
Okay.
It's not going to make her uncomfortable, and I don't mean shaving it down to the skin. I mean just keeping it much shorter so that whatever fecal material is back there, it doesn't have a lot to adhere to and dry on. Another thing is if she's not having normal stools, if they're soft or she's having problems with diarrhea, that sort of thing, talk to your vet about potentially changing her diet to a diet that may produce less fecal material or one that may improve the consistency of her stool, because again, that's going to improve reduce the amount that's sort of attached to that area. And also have your vet check her anal glands just to make sure that they're not becoming a problem, because those can oftentimes, there's little ducts that lead from those into the rectal area, and those can be clogged and cause more irritation.
Like in a dog?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Cats have them as well.
Right. Okay. Well, thanks for your advice.
Okay. Very good.
Bye.
Next caller is in Crete. This is our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes, I have some questions. My cats are getting a little older now. They're about 8 years old. The mother's about 9 or 10. Do you prefer something like wet food over dry food for those cats as they age now, or does it make any difference as long as it's balanced?
I don't really think it makes a lot of difference. A lot of it has to do with the cat's personal preference. There are certainly some cats out there that prefer wet or dry food. But as long as their diet that they're currently on isn't giving them any problems, I don't necessarily think that it's a problem. There are some people who may feel that wet food is better because it might improve their overall hydration and water intake, or that it's more natural or whatever. Honestly, a high-quality pet food, whether it's dry or canned, is going to be pretty well formulated to meet their nutritional needs. My cat actually has had several teeth extracted such that she pretty much doesn't have anything on the top or bottom behind her canines, and she still prefers her dry food. And so as far as, tooth pain or things like that, I don't think that there's any need to switch from dry food. But it really depends on just what your cats prefer in a lot of ways. There are occasional times we will, for certain health conditions, we will recommend one or the other for a particular pet. But if your pets are healthy, I would probably let them eat what they're happy eating.
A couple more questions. Can they get too much fish? They especially like fish, and then my wife's concerned that they're getting too much. Is there too much fish in the diet?
You know, if you're going to give them fish in the diet beyond the occasional little bitty treat, then I would probably stick to fish-flavored cat foods that are particularly formulated. An all-fish diet can cause some nutritional deficiencies in them. So what I would do is if they prefer the particular fish-flavored foods, I think that's fine as long as it's, a quality pet food that's been formulated to supplement those additional nutrients that they need.
And finally, one goes out once a day usually, and we use on a monthly basis Revolution. He doesn't especially care for the Revolution, and we were just wondering if there's another way of treating him for ticks, fleas, mosquitoes, whatever he might have a problem with when he goes out, and is the same thing could be applicable to the 4 or 5 that stay in on a regular basis?
Well, all of the various anti-parasiticals out there could be used, I think, on all of them, unless any of them have a particular health condition. I would talk to your vet about that. But there are certainly other products out there. There is a heartworm medication for cats that takes care of heartworms and intestinal parasites. That's a monthly oral medication. It's like a little flavored chew. There's also other topicals that are also formulated for fleas. But what it's probably going to mean, one of the nice things about Revolution is that it takes care of heartworms, fleas, and parasites and mites all in one application, whereas the other products, you may end up giving one thing to them orally to protect them against heartworm disease, and then another thing on their fur to reduce fleas, that sort of thing. But there are several products out on the market, and so I would definitely speak to your vet about it, about what they would recommend.
Did you mention a spray that we sprayed on the cats to keep them protected?
There are sprays available. They're not for heartworm disease. They would more be for fleas. One of the things that I would absolutely like to stress to people who own cats is that several of the flea sprays out on the market, particularly those that are over the counter at pet stores or the supermarket, are actually formulated with chemicals that are perfectly fine for dogs but can actually cause reactions in cats. And so I would definitely, if you have a cat that you want to put any sort of over-the-counter flea medication on, like the topical little drops you put on their back or any sprays or powders, to read the label very carefully and make sure that it's not, that it is safe to use on cats, because that certainly is something we are starting to see more of this time of year, where cats will be having reactions to flea products that were really formulated for dogs and may have some toxicity to cats.
So wouldn't they lick the spray off, or the other cats lick the spray off?
They may to some degree. I personally prefer the sort of oil-based topicals where you put a few drops sort of between their fur, over their backs, similar to how Revolution is applied. I think it's much less likely for them to be able to get enough off that it would reduce its effectiveness.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Champagne is next. Line number three. Hello.
Yes, hello. Mm-hmm. As we speak, I'm preparing for my golden retriever to come home from surgery at the U of I Vet Clinic. And I'd like to express my sincere appreciation to the vet clinic, Dr. Hoffer and Eve Chang and Chantel, for their compassionate care.
Thank you for telling us.
Absolutely. Oh, it was quite an experience, and it's a very emotional experience for the owners. As you can tell, my voice is quivering.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure you'll be very happy when your friend comes home.
Well, I'm going to be very happy, but it's going to be a long 3-month recuperation.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I would like to address that I'm really on my high horse about is indiscriminate breeding. And I know you guys see it all the time, the results of this.
Mm-hmm.
But if these breeders could see these puppies, and my dog isn't even 2 years old yet, and, you know, the suffering that they have to go through to keep them on their feet, they might reconsider what they're doing for their $500 puppy. I just wanted to bring that up. I don't think that enough attention is paid to this, and it's time that people took action. And I don't know what to do. I've called the American Kennel Club, and they really have no suggestions as to how to stop this person from breeding. And she knows she's doing it because she won't return my calls.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to mention this as a side note to this discussion, because pets are such an important part of people's lives. And when you purchase a puppy, it's a lifetime commitment. And thank God for the U of I for all the help they've given us.
I know that your concerns are shared by many, and certainly there are many wonderful purebred breeders out there who really work hard to ensure the quality of the pets in the particular breed. And then there are other breeders that don't put that effort into it. So, you know, I don't want to say that breeders are all irresponsible, because there are many, many wonderful ones. But
yes, I'm sure there are. But there are some that are just using this as pin money, and it's so easy to use the same dogs over and over again as father and mother to, you know, mm-hmm. to these litters.
Yeah.
And it just isn't fair to the puppies. I wish that they actually could witness what these puppies look like and how uncomfortable they are mm-hmm. after, well, mine had luxation of the patella today,
mm-hmm.
and in the future, hip dysplasia. is going to have to be addressed.
Mm-hmm.
And I know she's keeping on breeding.
Yeah.
And it really concerns me, and I think people really have to investigate before they go out and spend money and emotional investment in their puppies to make sure that these breeders are qualified.
I agree with you. I think that the best way to get that message out there is word of mouth, and I don't know of any regulatory agency that really oversees breeders unless it's the Department of Ag. But I don't think that there's much regulation, so I think that you know, working with dog clubs and just getting word of mouth out there, I think that's the best way that you can have effect in these sorts of situations.
I'm using this venue to express myself on this issue. I hope that you'll forgive me. It's not really a health issue now because that's been addressed, but I just wanted people listening in to be aware of what's going on with some of these breeders that just have little shacks in their backyard and call them appropriate for breeding dogs.
Yeah.
Well, best of luck with your pup.
And thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye.
I'm sure that it's a great suggestion to look for clubs, training clubs, like the training club of Champaign-Urbana. I'm sure that they would have a pretty good idea of who was around in this part of the state and who was doing breeding and who they would say would be good or not.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, if someone wants to have a dog in their life, they can go to the Humane Society, and there are plenty of mm-hmm. nice animals that need homes.
Mm-hmm.
But if you decide that what you really want is a purebred dog, what you really have to do is you got to do your homework, I think, and do as much as you can to ask around and try to find out, you know, is this a reputable breeder, and is this going to be a happy, healthy animal, and is that going to be a good addition to your family and not something where you're going to end up having a lot of problems and big vet bills and, you know, having everybody really be unhappy.
Yeah. You know, and it's the same thing about if anything you're buying. Ask breeders for references. Check into those references. Take a look at the facility. Ask to see the breeding facility. Ask to see the parents. You know, those sorts of things. And there's certainly no guarantee, but a lot of reputable breeders will also have the animal guaranteed for a vet visit, you know, and take them to a veterinarian as a new pet exam. And, you know, I know it's tough because these puppies and kittens are cute and you get bonded immediately. And the last thing you want to do is take it back, especially if it's a needy animal that's going to need some love and care. But mm-hmm. you need to be armed with knowledge.
Okay. Well, we have time for at least a couple more calls here, and we'll try to get in everybody. I don't know if we'll be able to. We'll try someone here on a cell phone calling from Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yes, hello. I have a cat question. Let me just give you a teeny bit of background. I run a dog rescue operation, and I currently have, for example, 15 caissons in the rescue in the house. And I also have four of my own cats. My daughter had to give up two of her cats, and I've taken them in. However, I'm having some difficulty getting those cats acclimated to rather strange circumstances from their perspective. But my main question is this. I know in general that dogs will not either starve themselves or stop drinking water if in general they're in good health. Is the same true for the cats? Because they're not eating, and I can't tell, but I have a worry that they may not be drinking. Should I just rest assured that since they're healthy and so on, that they will eventually eat and drink? And I'm going to hang up and just listen to you on the radio, okay?
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, unfortunately, cats are not quite the same as dogs in that respect, and your fear certainly may be well-founded because there certainly are those stubborn cats that when their circumstances change, they will go on a bit of a hunger strike. They're stressed. So anything you can do to try to reduce their stress, I realize you have probably quite the house full trying to keep everybody in order, but you know, it's important to make sure they do eat. If you can give them an area where they're maybe away from the dogs, whether it's a room, whether it be, you know, an area of the house you can close off and allow them to be maybe out of sort of the general fray, that might be give them a little bit of stress relief and comfort. Maybe put up perches or somewhere they can get to away from the dogs or even away from the other cats if they haven't quite acclimated to them yet. But certainly they do need to be encouraged to eat and drink. And if they don't, they absolutely can become ill. There's a condition called hepatic lipidosis in which the cat's metabolism changes in a starvation situation. And they can actually develop fatty liver disease, and it can be fatal. And one of the biggest ways to prevent it and even to treat it is to get them eating again. And so if you're having difficulty getting them to eat, maybe trying some favorite foods or treats and potentially even trying to find them a place where they can get away from the rest of the four-legged household might be helpful.
Okay. Let's see if we can do one more, and that would be line number two. Line number two in Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I'm discussing breeding of dogs and health problems. One of the things that people can be aware of when they're buying a purebred pet is to check that the breeder is a member of their national breed club. Most all national breed clubs have codes of ethics that say that certain health checks need to be done on the parents before they're bred, and that the people will not sell dogs to their puppies to pet shops and things like that. So that's one of the ways that a person can help ensure that they're dealing with a reputable breeder.
Does that that organization have a website?
All purebred breeds that are registered with the American Kennel Club have what we call their breed club, their national breed club. They're that are kind of the keepers of the breed,
mm-hmm.
and people that are breeding that breed are normally members of that national breed club. And all national breed clubs, just about, have codes of ethics that those people who are members have to sign saying they're adhering to.
Mm-hmm.
If a person buys a puppy from, say, I breed Alaskan Malamutes. If a person buys a puppy from me and that puppy has a defect that I could have been aware of or should have prevented, people can contact my national breed club and complain to my national breed club about me, and that hurts my reputation.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one way that you can help to keep people who are not doing the right thing breeding-wise from breeding.
That's great advice.
Yeah, we appreciate the suggestion. I'm going to have to jump in here just because we're at the end of the time and we're going to have to finish up. We want to say very much thanks to our guests, Julia Whittington and Julie Byron. They're both veterinarians and both at the part of the staff of the U of I Vet Medical Department. And thanks very much for spending some time with us and being
Thank
with
you.
Us. We
Thank
really
you.
Appreciate it.